Right. Well, his latest novel is The Hungry Ghosts. Shyam Salvadure joins me in studio right now to sit down and have a nice talk about it. Shyam, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, I'm curious what you would describe The Hungry Ghosts as, because it feels like it's a family story. It's a coming-of-age story. It's a political story. It's an immigrant story. There's multiple tangents or threads to this.
Mm-hmm.
Did you perceive of it as one thing when you sat down to write it, or like did it kind of unfold and it's like a tapestry?
Well, I mean, I suppose for myself, I am many things.
Mm-hmm.
And they exist in me without too much problem. So if it's just a question of trying to get, you know, I'm an immigrant, I'm gay, I'm Sri Lank, and I'm half Sinhalese, half Tamil. It's trying to get all that down into a book in some way that tells a story that's more than about that. I mean, and, you know, if you want to write a book about issues, then write a book about issues. But I'm a novelist. I want to tell a story. So, yes, I suppose the hard thing was trying to find balances for it. You know, like the levels on your board here, you know, like you just have to, you turn to one thing could be too loud and you have to turn it down. You just got to figure out how much of each to introduce in such a way that it doesn't affect the story and that it also seems as natural in the book as it is in my life.
That balance then, I mean, because there's multiple stories going on, not just, you know, that it being an immigrant story or it being, you know, about the Tamil Tigers or things like that, but in Siobhan's own life, there's, you know, he sort of is in the present walking around a house and going down to, you know, the reservoir or the
ravine. Yeah.
Ravine. But at the same time, when he backs up and tells stories, he kind of jumps around within his life.
Yeah.
How much did you sort of plot out what periods would be hit, at what point certain things would happen to him?
Well, I think, I mean, originally I just wrote the novel chronologically from beginning to end, and I felt it wasn't working. There was some energy that was missing from the language. And so then I came up with the idea of having a superstructure. And I didn't want to have the superstructure be somebody sitting at their desk writing their story, which I always find kind of dull. I felt that the book needed some sort of energy to it, some sort of urgency that would lend itself to language. And so what I did was I borrowed the structure for the book from James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room, which also takes place over a night of passionate remembering in which he's waiting for something to happen. And then once I'd figured that I was going to do that, then I basically printed out the entire novel in tiny font, cut it up into pieces and stuck it all over my study wall. And then I would move pieces around and stuff till I got to what was correct. I mean, the book is pretty chronological in that sense. There is the present sense, the present tense part where you come into the present, but most of the time it's going through his life in a chronological structure.
It's interesting you mentioned, you know, not sitting down and writing his story, kind of, you know, because that to me is Midnight's Children, right? That's the structure that Rushdie sort of set.
Yes, where and it's a lot
like
of other
recollection
people.
On his deathbed, essentially, right? Yeah. Baldwin's structure, like how recently had you read it that it kind of resonated, or did it just always stick in the back of your head?
You know, I read Giovanni's Room a long time ago. I mean, if you're gay, Giovanni's, and you're a reader, Giovanni's Room is one of those books that you definitely read that.
Pivotal book.
Yeah, The Dancer from the Dance. I mean, there's sort of a number of books like that you write. I mean, Rushdie's book, though, is not just simply a narrator narrating story. Rushdie's also referring to an older sort of Indian trope of somebody telling the story and being interrogated by a listener throughout the story. So, I mean, I'm sorry.
I certainly don't mind digressions. We've got time for digressions So, setting Siobhan in the home and then walking down to the ravine, putting him in that time leading up to the end of the book and having that be the sort of cause of his recollections, or that's, you know, allowing him that room to inhabit these spaces or fill this empty house.
Yes.
How soon or how early in the process did that idea hit you? Like, I mean, because you said you wrote it chronologically initially.
Yeah.
Did he end up in that house, like, chronologically initially, or did you kind of infill with the house?
No, I infilled the, I sort of created the structure of him spending that night. Well, I mean, he's preparing to return with his mother to Sri Lanka to bring the grandmother back because she's very sick, and they're bringing her back basically to die in Canada. And so it's his recollection of his life with his grandmother, but his life in general, which has been affected by his relationship with his grandmother. So that kind of remembering over the question of the period of a night, just it was something that I came up with quite a bit later.
You mentioned you bear some of the same facets as Siobhan. Mm. Did you look at this as an autobiographical, or like in some way to, I don't want to say mythologize, but like extemporize your experiences?
Well, yeah, he's born in the same year I was born in. He's Siobhan, I'm Shyam. He came here when he was 19. I came when I was 19. However, it's not me. It's not my story. I am an autobiographical writer in the sense that my work is always an autobiography of time, place, period, detail, feeling, and setting. But it's not a detail, it's not an autobiography of character and plot. In other words, that what happens to Siobhan in the book doesn't happen to me. However, he feels the same way arriving in Canada that I felt arriving in Canada. We ended up in the same suburb in which Siobhan and his family end up. His basement bedroom is an exact replica of my basement bedroom. I've just put him in it.
Right
under the wet carpet that used to get wet when the tub chairs where, you know, previous tenants had, you know, stubbed out their cigarette. But, I mean, we're so poor when we came to the country. You know, you couldn't afford to go out and buy new furniture. So whatever furniture you inherited with the house, you took it. Nor could we afford to get the problem with the plumbing fixed. So it wouldn't, you know, there wouldn't be a little bit of water all the time in the basement when you turn the washing machine on. Why did I do that? I think it's because I like to memorialize my life. I don't just put in the details for the sake of putting the details. I think that if the subject matter of your life is good enough for fiction, you should use it. I mean, the way Proust used his life for fiction. But I don't like to tell, I don't like memoir. I don't like to read it. And I certainly don't want to write it because it's dissatisfying. In the end, memoir has a paradox in it that to me is makes it dissatisfying. What memoir promises to do is tell you the truth, but it can't tell you the truth. It's one person's version of the truth. That same story told from the point of view of somebody else in that family would be completely different. And I'm very conscious when I'm reading memoir that that's the case. And so it's dissatisfying for me.
The Rashomon thing, where like ultimately there's multiple angles.
And yes, exactly.
The truth is sort of the formation of that whole.
Yes, well, it's in fiction, that's it. You know, what you've created is the only version. There's no alternate version to The Hungry Ghost because it's not true. And that's, in a sense, its greater truth.
Well, I think infilling with those details from your own life kind of provides like solidity or like a real kind of feel to the book, right? Yes, I mean, which I find interesting because, of course, it's called The Hungry Ghost, and it's supposed to be like, I mean, ephemeral in terms of ghosts, sort of their impact on the world, and they float through things, kind of the way Siobhan seems to float through the house at the contemporary portions of the book. But the you kind of feel like you're in that basement apartment.
Yes.
Did you move in with another family when you first came to Canada?
No, that's just all totally made up. I mean, that's where you've sort of intervened, where the fiction writer intervenes and creates something different, right? And is playing with levels of complication in terms of different points of migration, in a sense. I mean, that family that they initially end up with were earlier migrants to Canada and had to make greater compromises to fit in, whereas Siobhan and them are coming at the cusp of, at the flowering of multiculturalism. You know, multiculturalism has been around as a theory for a while, but when we came to the country, it was finally a fact. We brought it with us as a fact to the country, and so the country changed in a way to me, because we changed it. And I think that there's a difference between the immigrants who had been here before and Siobhan's family. They don't care if they're going to cook spices in their house, and they don't care if their coats smell of curry. They just don't give a damn. You know, they're just not thinking like that. Whereas and it's not important for them to think like that in order to fit in or to move forward economically, because everybody else is also now eating curry and cooking it in their houses.
Siobhan, at one point, when he after he's been in Canada, he goes back to see his grandmother and sort of starts running her business.
Yes.
And one of the comments is that running her business began to give me a feeling of manhood, which I realized I'd been denied in Canada because of my race.
Hmm.
I was curious because you said that this is, you know, built on some of your own experiences. Yeah. Was that your experience?
Yes, I think so too. I think as a visible minority person, you really find that there is a barrier against your rising up to a certain level in management and upper management or whatever, and or you have to work twice and thrice as hard in order to get to the same place. So I think that that's very true, and I think that continues to be true. So yes, he does in a sense, but he's also inheriting his privilege when he comes from an upper middle class family in Sri Lanka. So returning to Sri Lanka is to inherit that privilege, and that's questionable in the book whether it's a good thing or not.
Yeah, I mean, identity, obviously, it's a fluid thing, and circumstances change such that it changes how you feel about yourself. But Siobhan, more than anyone, sort of goes through these experiences where he, like, bounces around.
Yes.
And so his identity formation is especially fluid.
Mm.
And like you said, going back to Sri Lanka, where he is in a better place financially.
Yes.
Psychologically or developmentally, we can kind of leave that aside. Yeah. But, you know, unquestionably... living in the basement versus, you know, running his grandmother's business.
Yes.
That's a step up. That fluidity, like, did you always want to portray that, like, that about identity and like, through Siobhan? Was that...
Well, I think that there is a much greater fluidity right now for immigrants who come now because the return is very easy and the home is always present. I mean, it's just a click of a button away. You know, click your Skype button, and then there you are speaking to your friends in Facebook them. You're tweeting them now. You're aware of what's going on. The movies are coming out at the same time there and here. And there's a kind of greater fluidity for people now. And yes, I did want to reflect that because I hadn't really seen that in fiction before.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of fluid, that easy return and arrival and going back and forth between countries. Which is true for my life. I mean, I spend half my year, 5 months in Sri Lanka and the rest in Toronto. And so I just feel that, you know, and a lot of people are, you know, doing that now in my generation.
Well, I found it interesting because it was much harder for Siobhan's mother, right? Like, she wanted to be firm about where she stood.
Yes.
And I think she had trouble with the fact that Siobhan kind of vacillates.
Yes.
But I also thought maybe it's echoes of the way that Sri Lankan government kind of ebbed and flowed in terms of, like, the Tamils and,
yes.
you know, whether people are, you know, considered freedom fighters or terrorists, those
yes.
kinds of things yes. where give it a different day and the perspective is kind of flip-flopped.
Yes, yes. And I think the novel does allow for all those various points of view, but also the political situation as it is portrayed in the novel is tied to the thematic aspect of the novel, which is the cyclical nature of conflict and the fact that it reinvents itself over and over again. As we see in that Buddhist story, in one of the Buddhist stories, the demoness Kali, where these two women continue to carry their enmity through various generations. And I find that very, interesting.
That's not the only story that you kind of built into your own story.
Yeah.
I'm curious how much you wanted to incorporate from existing lore or mythology into your own book in terms of, like, building a new lore.
From the old Buddhist story?
Yeah, because there's a few stories, like the fellow who, like, doesn't look back, right?
Yes.
Because essentially, like, his past disappears as
yes.
he progresses
yes.
forward and
yes.
stuff, right?
That
there's multiple references to different stories. And, I mean, yes. certainly when Siobhan's young and his grandmother's telling
yes.
about things, but, you know, people kind of learn lessons through lore, right?
Yes.
And I'm
yes.
curious.
Well, what's fantastic about those stories is that they're simple, but they're also very complicated. What's, for me, what intrigued me about the Buddhist stories was that these early Buddhist storytellers found a way to take a very complicated philosophical idea, or complicated philosophical concepts, and translate it into narrative in a very simplistic way, in a simple way. And I wanted to be able to do the same thing in the book. I wanted to use those same narrative tropes in a modern context, such as karma. Just like in stories where, you know, something happens in one life and then they're born into a second life. and they're born into the next life and they're carrying that karma with them. I thought, wouldn't that be interesting that when that immigration, which is in a way is a kind of new life, you carry your past with you into it.
Right. Now, obviously, Siobhan's grandmother believes strongly in this in terms of, you know, her efforts to at her temple to look after it and you know, essentially earn her way into the good books.
Yes.
I'm curious about motivations and, like, you know, that does she believe she could be, like, really mean up to a certain point and then flip a switch and earn good karma? Or is there some realization that maybe that's not necessarily possible, and that if indeed she does believe in reincarnation, that this is an ongoing process, and that like those women in the enmities, she's going to have to carry some of this forward?
I think that the grandmother's version of karma reflects the perhaps the religious way in which karma is regarded in Sri Lanka, in Sri Lanka, among a lot of Sri Lankan Buddhists, where if you've done something, if you're suffering or you've done something bad, or you say, you know, having a, you're sort of poor or you're very sick or something, it's because of your karma. So in some sense, you deserve it. And so there's a way in which it produces the exact opposite effect of Buddhism, which is about compassion. You know, these people are uncompassionate because, you know, they don't really care. I mean, they say, oh, you deserve this. You are in this place, bad place, because this is what happened to you. The grandmother does believe that. She believes she's in a good place because she did something really good in her past life. She's rich, right? She's rich. And so that's because of she's led a good past life. And she's going to make sure that the next life she's even better off. And she's even happier by doing these various meritorious acts for the Buddhist monks, and their grand meritorious acts, in which she'll build a pavilion or something, and then her name will be inscribed on it. You see, so it's this kind of odd, it's like an odd, almost a kind of corruption of a travesty of the real idea of karma, which we see in the grandmother and which you see in Sri Lanka quite a bit.
The point at which when Siobhan goes back to Sri Lanka and he essentially takes over his grandmother's business of running these properties, there's an episode where a tenant in a building that he'd already visited before as a youth confronts him, is verbally assaultive, and it takes him aback. And then it sets in motion in terms of going to see Chandralal and basically seeking vengeance on this fellow.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, when he goes to deal with another tenant, and it's the teacher, he takes compassion. And I'm curious about his motivations. Is one just a reactive thing, and is the other like a more thought through, like, this is more in keeping with my personality?
No, I don't think many. I think when he decides to take over his grandmother's business, he really does get something very important from it, which he didn't get in Canada, which is a sense of achievement, a sense of you know, being able to, being good at something and achieving something, which he was not getting in Canada because of his race. So it's very complicated in that sense. However, he realizes soon after taking his grandmother's business, which involves managing a number of properties, that in order to deal with the situation, he has to resort to the same tactic his grandmother dealt with it. And on some level, I hope that the reader picks up that it was the only tactic available for them in that situation, because as the Chandralal, the thug whom the grandmother employs to deal with these difficult tenants, says, in Sri Lanka, it's always like two dogs fighting in the street, and one has to win. So there's this idea. And so Siobhan finds himself forced, because of his absolute desires to belong somewhere and to have this kind of success in his life, to compromise, like a lot of people do compromise a lot when, you know, in order to move up the corporate ladder or whatever. And he's doing the same thing. Is he naturally compassionate? Yes, he is, as far as he can possibly be, just like we are. But his issue is that he's hungry for things, like a hungry ghost. He desires so much that his desire is blinding him to the effect, the cost of what he wants.
I was going to say, Siobhan ultimately is the hungriest of the ghosts, in a sense, because he's unmoored in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And I'm curious, is that, this is the nature versus nurture argument, whether he's internally adrift or whether because of, you know, being uprooted and the issues with his mother versus his grandmother and the, like, family dynamics, you know, was he always going to be this adrift, or did the circumstances dictate that he became adrift?
I think it's a combination of circumstances and personality. But I felt very strongly that in this novel, I wanted to leave something mysterious about each of the characters. So you can't quite psychologize them through Western psychology. That there is something about them that is that the reader has to engage with, has to try to grapple with, which is inexplicable, which is true about all of us. I think there's parts of us that are mysterious, even to ourselves. And Western psychology fails at a certain, it reaches a certain point, but then it fails. It stops. It has its limit. And I think that it was very keen for me to show that. And of course, the way you deal with it in Eastern psychology is to say, it's my karma, it's destiny. Because it doesn't make sense in any other way. Does the grandmother really need to act like the way she does based on her past history? Perhaps not. Does the mother really have to make such a bad decision in her early life? Perhaps not. Does Shivan have to do this or that? Perhaps not. Why? Why do they do that? Why, when they come to two parts, do they take the left one and not the right one? How do we explain that? Yes, we can say psychologically, yes, it's because of these reasons in their background. But there's something else there in all our decisions as human beings, especially the major ones. There is something there that I feel like in my own life is just somehow beyond that. You know, it's beyond rationality. And I wanted to get to that in the characters of this book.
So then do you think we go back and try to, like,
yes,
ascribe a deeper understanding to something where in the moment we did not know? Like, we might be acting on impulse or, like, from some deep-seated need or desire that we're unable to kind of put our finger on?
I think we do go back and do that. But I think that the most important thing is perhaps not to... You should figure out the why, I suppose, or why I did something. But the more important thing is what now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what now?
This is possibly the first novel I've ever read where I've ended up essentially stealing a recipe from it.
Which one is that?
I ended up marinating corn in lime juice and chili powder.
Yes.
Before grilling it. Yeah. After reading a description of it,
yeah,
in your book. And you infill the place in terms of, you know, when he goes to the market, yeah, and the smells and the foods. Some of these foods are completely foreign to me, but yeah, in terms of describing food, you managed to kind of, like, make people taste it in a sense. Was that, like, conscious effort, or is that just something that comes naturally that you're able to kind of, like...
Well, no, actually, it's very hard for me to do that. I'm not a very good observer. It's a surprise to people to find that out, because the novel's always full of sensual detail.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes me forever to do that. But however, having said that, I believe very strongly that you shouldn't just describe something for the sake of describing it in a novel. That has to have an actual reason to be described. So when you talk about Shivan going into the market, what he's doing is he's actually going into the Kensington Market in Toronto, which is like atypically Toronto. It's not Toronto at all. You go down this lane and you're suddenly in, you know, you could be in an Eastern bazaar because it's full of the fruits and the vegetables and the meats of the East, you know, mm-hmm, the dried fish and stuff. So for him as an immigrant, he's in this kind of foreign environment. He goes down the street and he's like, oh my God, it smells like a Sri Lankan market. So that's when you're getting this whole... So just as he's getting inundated with the old, with the smells of home,
mm-hmm,
you as a reader are getting inundated with it. But I'm very careful. That's the only reason I'm doing it. I'm not just doing it to say, just to sort of provide description.
Right. This isn't some novelist who, you know, described the inner workings of a clock before, yes, telling you that it's, yeah, on the mantelpiece and, yes, then backing away from, yeah, that.
And by the way, you shouldn't marinate the corn in lemon or lime, just rub some on with some chili. I don't marinate it. I didn't realize you'd marinated it.
Well, there wasn't a specific recipe. Right, just, okay, he describes.
So you just rub it on and put it on the barbecue. It's delicious.
I thought it tasted pretty good after, yeah, marinating.
Oh, did you?
But thanks very much for taking some time to sit down and talk about the book. I
My
really
pleasure.
Appreciate it, and I really enjoyed this book.
Thank you.